Thank you for listening, and I hope you tune in for the next episode.
Thank you for listening to Let's Talk, Portland Community College's broadcast about disability culture. Find more information and resources concerning this episode and others at pcc.edu/DCA. This episode was produced by the Let's Talk Podcast Collective as a collaborative effort between students, the Accessible Education and Disability Resources Department, and the PCC Multimedia Department. We air new episodes bi-weekly on our home website, our Spotify channel, and monthly on KBOO Community Radio, 90.7 FM.
The Humane Society of the United States, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
Postmodern, a reaction against the ideas and values of modernism. Avant-garde, new, unusual, and experimental ideas. KBOO, a community radio station that supports both. Join us in our mission to push the status quo by becoming a member today. Go to kboo.fm/give between now and May 25th to donate and help us reach our $60,000 spring membership drive goal.
Tune in every second and fourth Saturday nights,
midnight
to 3 a.m. Sounds unsound. Sounds unsound.
Sounds unsound.
Only on KBOO.
Are you sure?
Sounds unsound.
KBOO.
The more compassion we have towards animals, the more compassion we're going to have towards other people.
If you can value them all, you really value yourself as well.
So even if you don't care about animals, the things we do that hurt animals end up hurting ourselves.
It's almost kind of a dominion type issue where we feel we need to control everything.
Dominion means stewardship, to take care of.
What would a cow think about satisfying our habit? The challenge lies with looking at suffering from the perspective of the person or individual suffering.
Hello and welcome to Voices for the Animals. I'm your host, Michelle Coppola. Back in February of this year, 42-year-old Cody Roberts of Daniel, Wyoming, ran over a 10-month-old female wolf in his snowmobile. The wolf didn't die immediately, but was traumatically injured. Now, instead of putting the animal out of its misery on sight, Roberts took the wolf home where he taped its mouth shut and then took several pictures of himself grinning ear to ear while holding that wolf by the neck. If it wasn't enough torture for the poor animal, he then took the terrified, dying, and bound young wolf to his favorite local bar and showed her off before he eventually killed her. Wyoming Game and Fish investigated this incident back in March and fined Roberts just $250. To show you how little that meant to Cody, Roberts has reportedly said the fine was, quote, worth it. I don't know of any better illustration of the fact that wolves have historically been some of the most maligned and hunted animals in this country. In some places, like rural Wyoming, that's still the case. In fact, Cody Roberts' aunt reportedly posted with the wolf's pelt, allegedly, on her Facebook page and told a reporter that wolves are nothing but, quote, evil. Ever since America was colonized by Europeans, wolves have been exterminated simply for trying to live. Today on Voices for the Animals, we are talking with Amarouk Weiss, Senior Wolf Advocate with the Center for Biological Diversity. And Maruk, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today.
You bet. I am thrilled to be here.
Yep. So before we zoom in on the current issues that are facing Western wolves in particular, can you give us a little bit of an overview as to why wolves are so integral to the ecosystem? Do they provide the same function as other big predators like grizzlies, or are there particular benefits that wolves can only give us?
You know, wolves hunt differently than grizzlies do, and they actually have a different diet than grizzlies do. I tend to think that the public often thinks that bears are all carnivores. They're actually omnivores. And although grizzlies do eat elk, they subsist on a lot of other things like berries and moths, the larvae of moths, and even pine nuts. And that's why, you know, climate change and the effects on the trees that produce pine nuts could have an impact on grizzly bears. But so wolves, they're really true carnivores. They will eat occasional some vegetation, some berries too, but what they really subsist on are wild ungulates. And that means whatever is where they're living. So if they live in the Arctic, they're eating muskox. And if they live in Canada, those wolves are probably eating caribou. Down here in the lower 48 United States, wolves tend to eat deer and elk and some moose. And so depending on what state you're in, what the populations is of those wild ungulates, that's what they'll be feeding on. And I think that more key to understand this relationship between wolves and what they eat is that those animals evolved together over thousands of years, over millennia. I mean, if you think elk are awesome because of how robust and athletic and agile they are, that's because they evolved with wolves. It's because they evolved to escape wolves. You know, and a quick aside on that, people think that wolves are really efficient predators. Well, they're not. All the studies they've been able to do in Yellowstone since wolves were reintroduced there, they've been able to do intensive studies of wolf-prey interactions in both winter and the spring, fall, summer seasons. And it turns out that wolves are only effective in catching their prey about 5 to 10% of their time. The rest of the time, they come home beat up, maybe with a fractured rib or a cracked skull. Sometimes they don't come home at all. So they're actually not very efficient hunters. They're going after the animals that are the most weak. And this is another really key reason that we want to have wolves back. What wolves do is that they target the animals that are going to be the easiest for them to hunt, the old, the sick, the weak, the young, the diseased. And so they are culling out of those ungulate herds the animals that otherwise either would have already died anyway because they were weak, or while they're alive, they're taking forage that the healthy reproductive members of the ungulate herd need to survive. And so they're actually helping keep those deer and elk herds healthier. And as proof of that, you know, sometimes we hear in wolf country and the Northern Rockies that the wolves are wiping out all the elk and the deer, and that's absolutely not true. The agency reports data that they collect themselves year over year over what are the elk populations, what are the deer populations. It turns out in Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, there are more elk there today than there were when wolves were first reintroduced there in 1995 and 96. So that's also just another piece of evidence that it's important to have those predators there to keep the prey herds healthy and abundant.
You know, this fact that wolves are so intimately tied to the environment really ties into my next question. You know, there are many varieties of wolves, and it seems that gray wolves and the western wolves are the subject of most of the legislation and conflicts in the U.S. But are there other wolves that have been equally as vilified and are as subject to the you know, the hunting and the vilification that we've seen in the West?
Yeah, so the main wolf we're talking about here is the species known as the gray wolf, Canis lupus. And gray wolves actually can be gray or black or white or cream colored or sable or something in between. But they're called the gray wolf. That is their scientific name. And they range throughout most of North America. By the time Europeans arrived here, there were something like 2 million gray wolves estimated to range across all of North America. And in the western United States and Mexico alone, they're estimated to have been about 380,000 gray wolves. So we're talking about a lot of animals. But the gray wolf also inhabits other parts of the northern hemisphere. Now, the U.S. does have another wolf species that was just as persecuted as the gray wolf. It is called the red wolf, K Canis rufus, that's its scientific name. And that wolf species historically inhabited parts of the eastern seaboard, down into the southeast, and all the way over to Oklahoma and Texas. And that species of wolf, just like the gray wolf, was wiped out after settlers arrived in this country and began clearing the land for their grain and their livestock. And so the red wolf also is just barely making a comeback through a recovery program for that species of wolf through a captive breeding program. Basically, a couple decades ago, the last handful of red wolves were brought into captivity to save the species. And from that captive breeding program, then wolves have been released into parts of the East Coast. But there too, just like out west, we're having the same political and policy conflicts where folks who don't want to tolerate wolves are causing a lot of havoc and causing a lot of problems for those recovery programs.
Let's talk about that a little bit, because as we have already touched on, as long as people have been farming and ranching in the U.S. and in the West, there has seemed to be a conflict with wolves to the point that they had bounties on their heads and they were hunted almost to extinction. I want to know, how much actual provable predation by wolves is there? Is there data that shows that wolves have a huge impact on livestock where they're present and tolerated?
Actually, the data shows the opposite, that there isn't a huge impact, because despite what the headlines in wolf country might imply, the wolf-caused losses of livestock are really just a fraction of a percent of all deaths and injuries to livestock. And we know this in part because ranchers and farmers self-report the numbers and causes of their livestock losses to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which has a National Agricultural Statistics Service. And that National Agricultural Statistics Service regularly issues reports on livestock death loss causes. And what those reports reveal is that the vast majority of losses, about 95% of cattle and calf losses and about 60% of sheep and lamb losses, are not caused by any predator of any kind. Instead, the bulk of those losses are from things like disease, starvation, dehydration, birthing complications, respiratory infections are rampant. Also, livestock die from eating poisonous weeds. And of the remaining percentage that are caused by predators, wolves are usually pretty far down the list. After coyotes, after domestic dogs, bears, cougars, bobcats, and eagles, domestic dogs running loose in the country kill and injure far more livestock than wolves do. And so just to give you a kind of like a percentage on that, in Idaho, where they've got 2.73 million livestock, wolf-caused losses amount to about 0.004% of their losses. And in Montana, which has about 2.65 million wolves, livestock losses there due to wolves amount to about 0.003% of their livestock. What is the message we can take from that? Well, number one, livestock losses due to wolves are very, very few, not nearly what the headlines will report to you. But number two, even of those losses that do occur, because that can be a big hit for an individual livestock owner. Nobody wants to lose your business equipment, right? It would be like someone stealing all the stereos out of your store. Of course, we don't put our stereos out in our parking lot and leave them overnight, whereas livestock are often just put out to graze with nobody monitoring them, which brings me to my second point. There are so many coexistence measures that are known to work to proactively prevent, before they even happen, conflicts between wolves and livestock. And there's a range of tools and strategies that are used and are being used in different parts of the country where they have wolves. And so these are things like hauling away or burying carcasses of any livestock that have died from other causes, because those carcasses, those bone piles, they draw in wolves, they draw in other predators. Having increased human presence, that means checking on your cattle and sheep regularly. You can keep your herds bunched up just like wild ungulate herds do. That teaches them to protect themselves. But you can also watch and see if they're acting nervous, and then you can be on the lookout for if there's predators that you need to scare away. And of course, if you're out there with them, that allows you to see if you have sick or injured livestock that you want to get off the range so that they're not attracting predators. That can be through using range riders on horseback. If you have sheep, It usually means having shepherds who are accompanied by livestock guardian dogs. There's a bunch of electronic scare devices that make loud noises if a radio collared wolf approaches and it scares them off. There's so many more methods that we don't have time to go into now.
That's just astounding, those statistics. I mean, because if you follow the livestock and ranching press at all, it seems that every death of any type of livestock, even when they can't show that it was preyed upon, they will want to blame a wolf.
Well, it's so true, and I'll give you a really fun example of that. One of my very, very favorite headlines ever came out of a newspaper in Eastern Oregon, and the article was titled, "Calf Found Dead, Not Killed by Wolf."
That was the headline? Before you go get your guns, right?
Yeah.
Wow, that's incredible. So I want to bring it up to the present day. You know, one of the things that I was struck by, I've always followed, you know, what's been going on with wolves. But the tumultuous history that they have had in this country is, it really is heartbreaking. And just back in February, the federal government, as you know, they declined to restore protections for gray wolves, saying they were in no danger of extinction at this time. At that same time, they also proposed a national recovery plan, especially since that same ruling also allows for aggressive state-sanctioned wolf hunts throughout the West. This all seems very contradictory to me. It's almost like the feds are saying, you guys in the states do what you want with wolves while we put together a plan to save them, even though they may again be decimated by the time that we do.
Yeah, well, so the policy wrangling and listing and delisting of wolves really has a complicated past. And so just kind of try to explain, we lost wolves in this country not because they lost habitat. That's what usually happens. That's what usually makes the species imperiled. But we lost wolves in this country because we killed them. And we killed them because European settlers who came here had a very different view on wolves than many of the Native American peoples who've been living here for thousands of years with wolves had. And so we wiped out wolves almost throughout the entire lower 48. At the behest of the livestock industry. And it wasn't until 1973 that by that time, we had like this social conscious change where we realized that we were destroying the planet. We were destroying our water, our air, habitat for other species and the species themselves. And so in this period of time, under a Republican administration, under Richard Nixon, a near unanimous vote in the House and a unanimous vote in the Senate to pass the Federal Endangered Species Act, along with other important environmental protection acts. And so in 1974, a year later, the gray wolf was listed for protection under the Endangered Species Act, and they were listed nationally. That is, they needed to be protected under the Endangered Species Act throughout the lower 48. They were listed as threatened in Minnesota and endangered everywhere else. And the only reason they had that lesser protection in Minnesota was because by that time, we had wiped out wolves everywhere except for far northeastern Minnesota. There was still a population of maybe 600 to 1,000 wolves there. And I'm from the Midwest. I know what those winters are like. My theory is the only reason that we didn't kill off those last wolves is because it was just too frickin' cold.
Right. I was about to say it's because there's no people up there.
it's very cold. So because of those protections, though, that meant that it was no longer legal to kill wolves. That allowed that Minnesota population to grow in size and expand into neighboring Michigan and Wisconsin. And then the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service also developed a recovery plan for the Northern Rockies. And the way they had to do that is that they captured wolves in Canada, brought them down and reintroduced them to Yellowstone National Park and into central Idaho. And that three-state region now, Idaho, Montana, Wyoming, has a wolf population. And then they developed a recovery plan in the Southwest for the most highly endangered subspecies of gray wolf, the Mexican gray wolf, which also had been driven to extinction in the U.S. They captured the last few down in Mexico, started a captive breeding program, started releasing those in 1998. So now think about this. We had wolves throughout the lower 48, but the recovery plans were only for those three postage stamp size portions of the country, Western Great Lakes, the Northern Rockies, and the Southwest. And over the years, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has repeatedly tried to strip federal protections from wolves nearly a dozen times over the last 20 years. And whenever they have stripped them of protections before a lawsuit could be filed and gotten those protections restored, once wolves have lost those federal protections, most of the states that have had wolves have instituted very aggressive hunting and trapping seasons that are designed to bring their wolf numbers down to bare bones. And then in 2011, Congress stepped in and forced U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to permanently delist wolves in the northern Rocky states. It's the first time Congress has done that, and didn't allow for that to be appealed in court. And so that's the instance you're talking about where we've seen such aggressive hunting and trapping regulations and laws passed, and particularly the last few years, even more aggressive, even more barbaric as to where, how, and when wolves could be killed. There was a brief time in 2021 when wolves again lost protection throughout most of the lower 48. And in Wisconsin, within just a few weeks, they opened a wolf hunting season and in 2.5 days' time killed 20 to 30% of their wolf population.
Oh my God.
Yes. So fortunately, we and other groups filed a lawsuit. We did get protections restored because it was very clear to the courts that wolves are not yet recovered and that the states don't provide appropriate safeguards once they lose federal protections. So wolves are still federally listed throughout most of the lower 48, but they are not listed in the northern Rockies. And that's because, as I said before, when Congress forced U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service to delist them, Congress put it into a rider on an appropriations bill, and it had language in it that said this could not be appealed in court. Now, that was 2011. So we move forward like more than 10 years, 10 to 12 years. We see Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming going crazy with all of these really anti-wolf hunting and trapping laws. We file another lawsuit, and so does another group, indicating that the service really has to relist them. We actually file what's called an administrative petition. It's not quite a lawsuit. Noting that the states are not managing wolves the way they said they would when they were delisted, and they're in danger of dropping down below limits that could really imperil the species again. So U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service denied that petition. We filed just about a month ago, maybe 2 weeks ago, our notice of intent to sue over that. The laws and regulations that have been passed in Idaho, Montana, and Wyoming have no basis in science. They're designed to bring their wolf numbers down to just skeletal numbers. That does not allow wolves to fulfill their role in the ecosystem, which is something we talked about at the beginning of this interview. It's so important to have them back because of the role they play in keeping everything else healthy.
Speaking of legal victories, just last month, a federal court prevented the state of Idaho from allowing wolf trapping and snaring in grizzly bear habitat. Can you talk a little bit about what happened there?
Yeah, so that was actually a lawsuit that was filed by our organization and several allies. And what we brought to the court's attention is that although wolves may no longer be federally protected in Idaho and Montana and Wyoming, the parts of the state where Idaho was now allowing just massive, nonstop, unending trapping and snaring of wolves was in habitat that's crucial for grizzly bears, which are still federally protected. And they're at great risk of stepping into a wolf trap or snare. And so what the court did, it didn't completely ban the use of traps or snares there like throughout the year, but it banned the use of traps and snares there during the time of year when bears are going to be not hibernating, when they're out and about. So from the early part of the year into around mid-December, I think. And that's really, really important. It's not just important for the bears, which of course it is important for, because if you have a bear that ends up in a trap or a snare, very often you may end up that you are orphaning cubs that mother bear has left at home in the den and needs to return to. At the same time, there's a real danger to humans who are out in the woods. You don't want to come upon a trapped, frantic, filled with pain bear. That's just not safe for humans either. Right. But I think that overall, I think we can all agree that, I hope we can all agree that no animal, whether it's a bear, a wolf, a coyote, or some other animal that has been incidentally trapped from what you've set your traps for. Sometimes it's eagles, sometimes it's deer, sometimes it's a dog.
We've had that happen here in Oregon where dogs have gotten stuck in snares, and it's a horrible, it's a painful, horrible, excruciating death for any animal, and really it's just very sad it's allowed at all.
Yes, it is. It's really an anachronism from the past. There's absolutely no reason to be doing that. You know, in Idaho, they're allowing trapping and snaring year-round when pelts from the animals that are trapped and snared aren't even worth anything for sale. So you can't make the argument that these are trappers who make their livelihood off these animals and they need to trap and snare to make their living. That's just not the case. And in fact, Idaho has even paid outside private entities to come in to do aerial gunning of wolves. That talk about an anachronism.
Right.
That's just not something that's done in wildlife management.
You know, they do it with the wild horse and burro populations in the West as well. I've had a couple of different shows on that, and it seems so much that our federal agencies are really in the pocket of ranching and livestock interests in this country. And, you know, the wildlife management, as they call it, is really nothing but legalized canned hunts.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. It is probably the great tragedy of our agency, our state and federal wildlife agencies, that for the most part, they view their clientele, their customer base, to be the livestock industry, the sports hunting industry. They fail to recognize that they have public trust obligations to all of the public, most of whom prefer to have our wildlife alive. And they owe that obligation and responsibility to care for, conserve, and steward wildlife that way, and for the intrinsic value of the wildlife themselves, because no matter what we ascribe to them, no matter whether we love them or hate them, these animals all have intrinsic value all on their own.
You know, I want to circle back to something that you touched on with an earlier answer. We were talking a bit about relocation. I wanted to ask you about some Oregon wolves that were transplanted to Colorado to help reintroduce wolf populations there. Of course, as you've mentioned, the public wholly supported this with a vote in Colorado. Ranching and livestock interests are very much against it. I wanted to know if you had any updates as to how those wolves are acclimating there in Colorado, how they're doing.
The state agency in Colorado has periodically provided updates because all of the wolves were collared before they were set free in Colorado. And so they have been able to follow them. They're not sticking right to where they were released. They have wandered some into neighboring counties. Just this last week, the agency released some news that a radio collar on one of the animals is failing and another one is having problems. It's being sporadically working, which is what can happen with radio collars all the time.
Right.
They're intended to last for about 3 years, and how long they last depends upon the battery life, and the battery life depends on how many data points a day you're asking the collar to detect and send up to that satellite in the sky. As far as reports we've received, they're all still alive and they are moving around, and there have not been any conflicts between livestock and the wolves that were released there.
So I want to ask, in your opinion, is there any way to really resolve this conflict between, the livestock and cattle interests and making sure that wolves thrive in this country? I mean, I have to say that reading the press, it seems like a lot of those interests would not be satisfied with anything less than a complete eradication of wolves and other apex predators. To your mind, is there any way to have a compromise of this conflict?
First of all, it's my perception that that loud voice of wanting to exterminate wolves all over again is not the majority of the livestock owners, is not the majority of the hunting community. There's plenty of people in both of those camps who aren't willing to share the landscape. The problem is that there are some very loud voices from a minority of people who get the ear of the state legislator, get the ear of the congressperson, get the ear of the governor, or maybe even the governor already agrees with them. That's their view. And so they have oversized power. I think part of the answer to getting that dynamic change is, number one, at the federal and state agencies, helping them to see how small of a constituency that is, that in fact most people would be fine trying to live peaceably with these animals. And so part of that is getting the agency out of the mindset that these are their only customers.
I want to thank you for that insight, because I'll be honest with you, until you said that, I was not aware that there was a significant portion of that population who really was interested in living peaceably with these animals.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, Michelle. I mean, we know this because when groups put on workshops in rural parts where there are wolves, where they're teaching them ranching resiliency, ways to ranch to protect your livestock, not just from wolves, but from other predators, so that you can make your business as profitable as it can be, people show up for those workshops. People are interested in learning those methods, and they're tired of all the fighting and arguing and grandstanding. There's a lot of people in those communities who are nervous to speak up. Many ranchers will use non-lethal methods to deter conflicts, but not tell their neighbors that they're doing that, not tell their neighbors that they're working with a group that's helping them improve their proactive conflict prevention methods, because they're afraid of getting shamed.
That is so interesting. I mean, really, that, and it also gives me a lot of hope.
Yeah, I think there is reason for hope, and I think it's really important that we hope. You know, hope exists in darkness, right? And I think that what you find when you scratch beneath the surface, you really do find that there are more people that are interested and willing. I think that we have other kind of conflicting environmental issues that get tied up in this. So, for instance, the desire to do mining and drilling for oil and gas that come out of states that have like large tracts of public lands. And those public lands, they do belong to all the public, but there are corporate interests who